Thank you for that. But I will not hold you to that promise. Dig through his mind if you must. There is more to all of this for me than there is for you, you know. For you, this is about the Institute and the safety of shadow hunters. I care about those things too, Charlotte. But Nate, he is working with Mortmain. Mortmain, who wants to trap me and use me, and for what we still do not know. Mortmain, who may know what I am. Nate told Jessamine my father was a demon and my mother was a shadow hunter. Will sat up straight.
That's impossible, he said.
Shadow hunters and demons, they cannot procreate, they cannot produce living offspring. Then maybe it was a lie, like the lie about Mortmain being an Idris, said Tessa. That doesn't mean Mortmain doesn't know the truth. I must know what I am. If nothing else, I believe it is the key to why he wants me. There was sadness in Jem's eyes as he looked at her, and then away.
Very well, he said.
Will, how do you propose we lure him to a meeting?
Don't you think he knows Jessamine's handwriting? Isn't it likely they have some secret signal between them?
Jessamine must be convinced, said Will, to help us.
Please don't suggest we torture her, said Jem irritably. The mortal sword has already been used. She has told us all she can.
The mortal sword did not give us their meeting places, or any codes or pet names they might have used, said Will.
Don't you understand? This is Jessamine's last chance. Her last chance to cooperate, to get leniency from the Clave, to be forgiven.
Even if Charlotte keeps the Institute, do you think they will leave Jessamine's fate in our hands? No. It would be left to the Consul and the Inquisitor, and they will not be kind. If she does this for us, it could mean her life.
I am not sure she cares about her life, said Tessa softly.
Everyone cares, said Will. Everyone wants to live.
Jem turned away from him abruptly and stared into the fire.
The question is, who can we send to persuade her? Said Charlotte.
I cannot go. She hates and blames me most of all.
I could go,
Henry said, his gentle face troubled.
I could perhaps reason with the poor girl, speak with her of the folly of young love, how swiftly it fades in the face of life's harsh reality. No.
Charlotte's tone was final.
Well, I highly doubt she wishes to see me, said Will. It'll have to be Jem. He's impossible to hate. Even that devil cat likes him.
Jem exhaled, still staring into the fire.
I will go to the Silent City, he said. But Tessa should come with me.
Tessa looked up, startled.
Oh, no,
she said. I do not think Jessamine likes me much. She feels I have betrayed her terribly by disguising myself as her, and I cannot blame her.
Yes, said Jem. But you are Nate's sister.
If she loves him, as you say she does.
His eyes met hers across the room.
You know Nate. You can speak of him with authority.
You may be able to make her believe what I cannot.
Very well, Tessa said. I will try.
This seemed to signal the end of breakfast. Charlotte darted off to call for a carriage to come for them from the Silent City. It was how the brothers liked to do things, she explained. Henry returned to his crypt and his inventions, and Jem, after a murmured word to Tessa, went to gather his hat and coat. Only Will remained, staring into the fire, and Tessa, seeing that he was not moving, waited until the door shut behind Jem and came around to stand between Will and the flames. He raised his eyes to her slowly. He was still wearing the clothes he had been wearing the night before, though his white shirt front was stained with blood, and there was a long, jagged rent in his frock coat. There was a cut along his cheek, too, under his left eye.
Will,
she said, aren't you meant to be leaving with Jem?
And I shall, she replied, but I need a promise from you first.
His eyes moved to the fire. She could see the dancing flames reflected in his pupils.
Then tell me what it is quickly. I have important business to get to.
I plan to sulk all afternoon,
followed perhaps by an evening of Byronic brooding and a night-time of dissipation.
Dissipate all you like. I only want your assurance that you will tell no one what transpired between us last night, on the balcony.
Oh, that was you, said Will, with the air of someone who has just recollected a surprising detail. Spare me, she snapped, stung despite herself. We were under the influence of warlock powders. It meant nothing. Even I do not blame you for what happened, however tedious you are being about it now, but there is no need for anyone else to know. And if you were a gentleman...
But I am not.
But you are a shadow hunter, she said venomously. And there is no future for a shadow hunter who dallies with warlocks.
His eyes danced with fire. He said, You have become boring to tease, Tess.
Then give me your word you will tell no one, not even Jem, and I will go away and cease to bore you.
You have my word on the angel, he said. It was not something I had planned to brag of in the first place. Though why you are so keen that no one here suspect you of a lack of virtue, I do not know.
Jem's face flashed across her inner eye. No, she said.
You truly don't.
And with that she turned on her heel and stalked from the room, leaving him staring after her in confusion. Sophie hurried down Piccadilly, her head bent, her eyes on the pavement beneath her feet. She was used to hushed murmurs and the occasional stare when she went out, and eyes fell upon her scar. She had perfected a way of walking that hid her face beneath the shadow of her hat. She was not ashamed of the scar, but she hated the pity in the eyes of those who saw it. She was wearing one of Jessamine's old dresses. It was not out of fashion yet, but Jessamine was one of those girls who dubbed any dress she had worn more than 3 times historical, and either cast it off or had it made over. It was a striped, watered silk in green and white, and there were waxy white flowers and green leaves on her hat. Altogether, she thought, she could pass for a girl of good breeding, if she were not out on her own, that was, especially with her work-roughened hands covered in a pair of white kid gloves. She saw Gideon before he saw her. He was leaning against a lamppost outside the great pale green porte cochere of Fortnum and Mason. Her heart skipped a little beat as she looked at him, so handsome in his dark clothes, checking the time on a gold watch affixed to his waistcoat pocket by a thin chain. She paused for a moment, watching the people stream around him, the busy life of London roaring around him, and Gideon as calm as a rock in the middle of a churning river. All shadow hunters had something of that to them, she thought, that stillness, that dark aura of separateness that set them apart from the current of mundane life. He looked up then and saw her, and smiled that smile that changed his whole face. "Miss Collins," he said, coming forward, and she moved forward to meet him as well, feeling as she did so, as if she were stepping into the circle of his separateness. The steady noise of city traffic, pedestrian and otherwise, seemed to dim, and it was just her and Gideon facing each other on the street.
"Miss Lightwood," she said.
His face changed, only a little, but she saw it. She saw, too, that he was holding something in his left hand, a woven picnic basket. She looked at it, and then at him.
"One of Fortnum and Mason's famous hampers," he said with a sideways smile. "Stilton cheese, quail's eggs, rose petal jam."
"Miss Lightwood,"
she said again, interrupting him to her own amazement.
A servant never interrupted a gentleman.
"I have been most distressed in my own mind, you understand, as to whether I should come here at all. I finally decided that I should, if only to tell you to your own face that I cannot see you. I thought you deserved that much, though I am not sure of it."
He looked at her, stunned, and in that moment she saw not a shadow hunter, but an ordinary boy, like Thomas or Cyril, clutching a picnic basket, and unable to hide the surprise and hurt on his face.
"Miss Collins, if there is something I have done to offend—"
"I cannot see you, that is all,"
Sophie said, and turned away, meaning to hurry back the way she had come.
If she was quick, she could catch the next omnibus back to the city.
Miss Collins, please.
It was Gideon at her elbow. He did not touch her, but he was walking alongside her, his expression distraught.
Tell me what I've done.
She shook her head mutely. The look on his face. Perhaps it had been a mistake to come. They were passing Hatchard's bookshop, and she considered ducking inside. Surely he would not follow her, not into a place where they'd likely be overheard. But then again, perhaps he would.
I know what it is, he said abruptly. Will. He told you, didn't he?
The fact that you say that informs me that there was something to tell.
Miss Collins, I can explain. Just come with me, this way.
He turned, and she found herself following him, warily. They were in front of St. James's Church. He led her around the side and down a narrow street that bridged the gap between Piccadilly and Jermyn Street. It was quieter here, though not deserted. Several passing pedestrians gave them curious looks. The scarred girl and the handsome boy with the pale face, carefully setting his hamper down at his feet.
This is about last night,
he said.
The ball at my father's house in Chiswick. I thought I saw Will. I had wondered if he would tell the rest of you.
You confess it, then, that you were there, at that deprived, that unsuitable...
Unsuitable? It was a sight more than unsuitable,
said Gideon, with more force than she had ever heard him use. Behind them, the bell of the church tolled the hour. He seemed not to hear it.
Miss Collins, all I can do is swear to you that until last night I had no idea with what low company, what destructive habits my father had engaged himself. I have been in Spain this past half year.
And he was not like this before that?
Sophie asked, disbelieving.
Not quite. It is difficult to explain.
His eyes strayed past her, their grey-green stormier than ever.
My father has always been one to flout convention. To bend the law, if not to break it. He had always taught us that this is the way that everyone goes along, that all shadow hunters do it. And we, Gabriel and I, having lost our mother so young, had no better example to follow. It was not until I arrived in Madrid that I began to understand the full extent of my father's incorrectness. Everyone does not flout the law and bend the rules, and I was treated as if I was some monstrous creature for believing it to be so, until I changed my ways. Research and observation led me to believe I had been given poor principles to follow and that it had been done with deliberation. I could only think of Gabriel and how I might save him from the same realization, or at least from having it delivered so shockingly.
And your sister, Miss Lightwood?
Gideon shook his head.
She has been sheltered from it all. My father thinks that women have no business with the darker aspects of Downworld. No, it is I who he believes must know of his involvements, for I am the heir to the Lightwood estate. It was with an eye to that that my father brought me with him to the event last night, at which, I assume, Will saw me.
You knew he was there?
I was so disgusted by what I saw inside that room that I eventually fought my way free and went out into the gardens for some fresh air. The stench of demons had made me nauseated. Out there, I saw someone familiar chasing a blue demon across the parkland with an air of determination.
Mr. Arendelle?
Gideon shrugged.
I had no idea what he was doing there. I knew he could not have been invited, but could not fathom how he had found out about it, or if his pursuit of the demon was unrelated. I wasn't sure until I saw the look on your face when you beheld me just now.
Sophie's voice rose and sharpened.
But did you tell your father, or Gabriel, do they know, about Master Will?
Gideon shook his head slowly.
I told them nothing. I do not think they expected Will there in any capacity. The shadow hunters of the Institute are meant to be in pursuit of Mortmain.
They are,
said Sophie slowly. And when his only look was one of incomprehension, she said,
Those clockwork creatures at your father's party, where did you think they came from?
I didn't. I assumed they were demon playthings of some sort.
They can only have come from Mortmain, said Sophie.
You haven't seen his automatons before. But Mr. Arendelle and Miss Gray, they have, and they were sure.
But why would my father have anything of Mortmain's?
Sophie shook her head.
It may be that you should not ask me questions you don't want the answer to, Mr. Lightwood.
Miss Collins.
His hair fell forward over his eyes. He tossed it back with an impatient gesture.
Miss Collins, I know that whatever you tell me, it will be the truth. In many ways, of all those I have met in London, I find you the most trustworthy. More so than my own family.
That seems to me a great misfortune, Mr. Lightwood, for we have known each other only a little time indeed.
I hope to change that. At least walk to the park with me, Soph. Miss Collins, tell me this truth of which you speak. If then you still desire no further connection with me, I will respect your wishes. I ask only for an hour or so of your time.
His eyes pleaded with her.
Please.
Sophie felt, almost against her will, a rush of sympathy for this boy with his sea-storm eyes, who seemed so alone.
Very well, she said. I will come to the park with you.
An entire carriage ride alone with Jem, Tessa thought, her stomach clenching as she drew on her gloves and cast a last glance at herself in the pier glass in her bedroom. Just 2 nights ago, the prospect had precipitated in her no new or unusual feelings. She had been worried about Will, and curious about Whitechapel, and Jem had gently distracted her as they had rolled along, speaking of Latin and Greek and Parabatai. And now? Now she felt like a net of butterflies was loose in her stomach at the prospect of being shut up in a small, close space alone with him. She glanced at her pale face in the mirror, pinched her cheeks, and bit her lips to bring color into them, and reached for her hat on a stand beside the vanity. Settling it on her brown hair, she caught herself wishing she had golden curls like Jessamine, and thought, could I? Would it be possible to change just that one small part of herself? Give herself shimmering hair? Or perhaps a slimmer waist? Or fuller lips? She whirled away from the glass, shaking her head. How had she not thought of that before? And yet the mere idea seemed like a betrayal of her own face. Her hunger to know what she was still burned inside her. If even her own features were no longer the ones she'd been born with, how could she justify this demand, this need to know her own nature?
"Don't you know there is no Tessa Gray?" Mortmain had said to her.
If she used her power to turn her eyes sky blue, or to darken her lashes, wouldn't she be proving him right? She shook her head, trying to cast the thought off, as she hurried from her room and down the steps to the Institute's entryway. Waiting in the courtyard was a black carriage, unmarked by any coat of arms and driven by a pair of matched horses, the color of smoke. In the driver's seat sat a silent brother. It was not Brother Enoch, but another of his brethren that she didn't recognize. His face was not as scarred as Enoch's, from what she could see beneath the hood. She started down the steps, just as the door opened behind her and Jem came out. It was chilly, and he wore a light gray coat that made his hair and eyes look more silver than ever. He looked up at the equally gray sky, heavy with black-edged clouds, and said,
"We'd better get into the carriage before it starts to rain."
It was a perfectly ordinary thing to say, but Tessa was struck speechless all the same. She followed Jem silently to the carriage and allowed him to help her in. As he climbed in after her and swung the door shut behind them, she noticed he was not carrying his sword cane. The carriage started forward with a lurch. Tessa, her hand at the window, gave a cry.
"The gates! They're locked! The carriage!"
"Hush!" Jem put his hand on her arm. She couldn't help a gasp as the carriage rumbled up to the padlocked iron gates and passed through them, as if they had been made of no more substance than air. She felt the breath go out of her in a whoosh of surprise.
"The Silent Brothers have strange magic," said Jem, and dropped his hand.
At that moment, it began to rain, the sky opening up like a punctured hot water bottle. Through the sheets of silver, Tessa stared as the carriage rolled through pedestrians as if they were ghosts, slipped into the narrowest cracks between buildings, rattled through a courtyard and then a warehouse, boxes all around them, and emerged finally on the embankment, itself slick and wet with rain beside the heaving grey water of the Thames.
"Oh, dear God," Tessa said, and drew the curtain shut. "Tell me we aren't going to roll into the river."
Jem laughed. Even through her shock, it was a welcome sound.
"No. The carriages of the Silent City travel only on land, as far as I know. Though that travel is peculiar. It's a bit sickening the first time or two, but you get used to it."
"Do you?" She looked at him directly.
This was the moment. She had to say it before their friendship suffered further, before there could be more awkwardness. "Jem," she said.
"Yes?"
"I... you must know how very much your friendship means to me,"
she began awkwardly.
"And..."
A look of pain flashed across his face.
"Please don't."
Thrown off her stride, Tessa could only blink.
"What do you mean?" "Every time you say that word, friendship, it goes into me like a knife," he said. "To be friends is a beautiful thing, Tessa, and I do not scorn it, but I have hoped for a long time now that we might be more than friends. And then I have thought, after the other night, that perhaps my hopes were not in vain. But now..."
"Now I have ruined everything," she whispered.
"I am so sorry."
He looked toward the window. She could sense that he was fighting some strong emotion.
"You should not have to apologize for not returning my feelings."
"But Jem..."
She was bewildered and could think only of taking his pain away, of making him feel less hurt.
"I was apologizing for my behavior that other night. It was forward and inexcusable. What you must think of me."
He looked up in surprise.
"Tessa, you can't think that, can you? It is I who have behaved inexcusably. I have barely been able to look at you since, thinking how much you must despise me."
"I could never despise you," she said.
"I have never met anyone as kind and good as you are. I thought it was you who were dismayed by me, that you despised me."
Jem looked shocked.
"How could I despise you when it was my own distraction that led to what happened between us? If I had not been in such a desperate state, I would have shown more restraint."
"He means he would have had enough restraint to stop me," Tessa thought. "He does not expect propriety of me. He assumes it would not be in my nature." She stared fixedly at the window again, or the bit of it she could see. The river was visible, black boats bobbing on the tide, the rain mixing with the river.
"Tessa!"
He scrambled across the carriage so that he was sitting beside her rather than across from her, his anxious, beautiful face close to hers. "I know that mundane girls are taught that it is their responsibility not to tempt men, that men are weak and women must restrain them.
I assure you, Shadowhunter mores are different, more equal. It was our equal choice to do what we did."
She stared at him.
He was so kind, she thought.
He seemed to read the fears in her heart and move to dispel them before she could speak them aloud. She thought then of Will, of what had transpired between them the previous evening. She pushed away the memory of the cold air around them, the heat between their bodies as they clung together. She had been drugged, as had he. Nothing they had said or done meant anything more than an opium addict's babbling. There was no need to tell anyone. It had meant nothing.
Nothing. "Say something, Tessa."
Jem's voice shook.
"I fear that you think that I regret that night. I do not."
His thumb brushed over her wrist, the bare skin between the cuff of her dress and her glove.
"I only regret that it came too soon. I would have wanted to court you first. To take you driving with a chaperone."
"A chaperone?" Tessa laughed despite herself. He went on determinedly.
"To tell you of my feelings first, before I showed them.
to write poetry for you.
You don't even like poetry, Tessa said, her voice catching on a half-laugh of relief.
No, but you make me want to write it.
Does that not count for anything? Tessa's lips curled into a smile. She leaned forward and looked up into his face, so close to hers that she could make out each individual silvery eyelash on his lids, the faint white scars on his pale throat where once there had been marks.
That sounds almost practiced, James Carstairs. How many girls have you made swoon with that observation?
There is only one girl I care to make swoon, he said. The question is, does she?
She smiled at him. She does.
A moment later, she did not know how it had happened, he was kissing her, his lips soft on hers, his hand rising to cup her cheek and chin, holding her face steady.
Tessa heard a light crinkling and realized it was the sound of the silk flowers on her hat being crushed against the side of the carriage as his body pressed hers back. She clutched at his coat lapels, as much to keep him close as to stop herself from falling over. The carriage came to a jerking halt. Jem drew back from her, looking dazed.
By the angel? He said.
Perhaps we do need a chaperone. Tessa shook her head.
Jem still looked stunned. I think I'd better sit over here, he said, and moved to the seat across from hers.
Tessa glanced toward the window. Through the gap in the curtains she saw that the Houses of Parliament loomed above them, towers framed darkly against the lightening sky. It had stopped raining. She was not sure why the carriage had stopped. Indeed, it rumbled into life a moment later, rolling directly into what seemed a pit of black shadow that had opened up before them. She knew enough not to gasp in surprise this time. There was darkness, and then they rolled out into the great room of black basalt, lit with torches that she remembered from the council meeting. The carriage stopped and the door flew open. Several silent brothers stood on the other side. Brother Enoch was at their head. Two brothers flanked him, each holding a burning torch. Their hoods were back. Both were blind, though only one, like Enoch, seemed to have missing eyes. The others had eyes that were shut, with runes scrawled blackly across them. All had their lips stitched shut.
"Welcome again to the Silent City, daughter of Lilith," said Brother Enoch. For a moment Tessa wanted to reach behind herself for the warm pressure of Jem's hand on hers, let him help her out of the carriage. She thought of Charlotte then. Charlotte, so small and strong, who leaned on no one. She emerged from the carriage on her own, the heels of her boots ringing on the basalt floor.
"Thank you, Brother Enoch," she said. "We are here to see Jessamine Lovelace. Will you take us to her?"
The prisons of the Silent City were beneath its first level, past the pavilion of the speaking stars. A dark staircase led down. The Silent Brothers went first, followed by Jem and Tessa, who had not spoken to each other since they left the carriage. It was not an awkward silence, though. There was something about the haunting grandeur of the City of Bones, with its great mausoleums and soaring arches, that made her feel as if she were in a museum or church, where hushed voices were required. At the bottom of the stairs, a corridor snaked in two directions. The Silent Brothers turned to the left and led Jem and Tessa nearly to the end of the hall. As they went, they passed row after row of small chambers, each with a barred, padlocked door. Each contained a bed and washstand and nothing else. The walls were stone, and the smell was of water and dampness. Tessa wondered if they were under the Thames or somewhere else altogether. At last, the brothers stopped at a door, the second to the last on the hall, and Brother Enoch touched the padlock. It clicked open, and the chains holding the door shut fell away.
"You are welcome to enter," said Enoch, stepping back. "We will be waiting for you outside."
Jem put his hand to the door handle and hesitated, looking at Tessa.
Perhaps you should talk to her for a moment alone. Woman to woman. Tessa was startled. Are you sure? You know her better than I do. But you know Nate, said Jem, and his eyes flicked away from her briefly. Tessa had the feeling there was something he was not telling her. It was such an unusual feeling when it came to Jem that she was not sure how to react. I will join you in a moment, once you have put her at ease. Slowly Tessa nodded. Brother Enoch swung the door open and she walked inside, flinching a little as the heavy door crashed to behind her. It was a small room, like the others, stone-bound. There was a washstand and what had probably once been a ceramic jug of water. Now it was in pieces on the floor, as if someone had thrown it with great force against the wall. On the narrow bed sat Jessamine, in a plain white gown, a rough blanket wrapped around her. Her hair fell around her shoulders in tangled snakes, and her eyes were red.
Welcome! Nice place to live out of, isn't this? Jessamine said.
Her voice sounded rough, as if her throat were swollen from crying. She looked at Tessa, and her lower lip began to tremble.
Did Charlotte send you to bring me back?
Tessa shook her head.
No.
But...
Jessamine's eyes began to fill.
She can't leave me here. I can hear them all night.
She shuddered, pulling the blanket closer around her. You can hear what?
The dead,
she said.
Whispering in their tombs. If I stay down here long enough, I will join them. I know it.
Tessa sat down on the edge of the bed and carefully touched Jessamine's hair, stroking the snarls lightly. That won't happen, she said, and Jessamine began to sob. Her shoulders shook. Helplessly, Tessa looked around the room, as if something in the miserable cell might give her inspiration. Jessamine, she said, I brought you something. Jessamine very slowly raised her face.
Is it from Nate?
No, Tessa answered gently. It's something of yours. She reached into her pocket and drew it out, extending her hand toward Jessamine. In her palm lay a tiny baby doll that she had taken from its crib inside Jessamine's dollhouse. Baby Jessie. Jessamine made an oh sound low in her throat and plucked the doll from Tessa's grasp. She held it tightly against her chest. Her eyes spilled over, her tears making tracks in the grime on her face. She really was a most pitiful sight, Tessa thought. If only... Jessamine, Tessa said again. She felt as if Jessamine were an animal in need of gentling, and that repeating her name in a kind tone might somehow help. We need your help.
In betraying Nate,
Jessamine snapped.
But I don't know anything. I don't even know why I'm here.
Yes, you do. It was Jem coming into the cell. He was flushed and a little out of breath, as if he had been hurrying. He shot Tessa a conspiratorial glance and closed the door behind him. You know exactly why you're here, Jessie.
Because I fell in love,
Jessamine snapped.
You want to know what it's like? I see how you look at Tessa.
She shot Tessa a poisonous look as Tessa's cheeks flamed.
At least Nate is human.
Jem didn't lose his composure. I haven't betrayed the Institute for Tessa, he said. I haven't lied to and endangered those who have cared for me since I was orphaned.
If you wouldn't, said Jessamine, you don't really love her.
If she asked me to, said Jem, I would know she did not really love me. Jessamine sucked in a breath and turned away from him, as if he had slapped her face.
You,
she said in a muffled voice.
I always thought you were the nicest one, but you're horrible. You're all horrible. Charlotte tortured me with that mortal sword until I told everything. What more could you possibly want from me? You've already forced me to betray the man I love.
At the very corner of Tessa's vision, she saw Jem roll his eyes. There was a certain theatricality to Jessamine's despair, as there was to everything she did, but under it, under the role of wronged woman Jessamine had cast herself in, Tessa felt she was genuinely afraid.
"I know you love Nate," Tessa said, "and I know that I will not be able to convince you that he does not return your sentiment."
"You're jealous!"
"Jessamine, Nate cannot love you. There is something wrong with him, some piece missing from his heart. God knows my aunt and I tried to ignore it, to tell each other it was boyish hijinks and thoughtlessness. But he murdered our aunt."
"Did he tell you that?"
"Murdered the woman who brought him up, and laughed to me about it later. He has no empathy, no capacity for gratitude. If you shield him now, it will win you nothing in his eyes."
"Nor is it likely you will ever see him again," said Jem. "If you do not help us, the Clave will never let you go. It will be you and the dead down here for eternity, if you are not punished with a curse."
"Nate said you would try to frighten me," said Jessamine, in a sliver of a voice.
"Nate also said the Clave and Charlotte would do nothing to you because they were weak," said Tessa. "That has not proven true. He said to you only what he had to say, to get you to do what he wanted you to. He is my brother, and I tell you, he is a cheat and a liar."
"We need you to write a letter to him," said Jem, "telling him you have knowledge of a secret Shadowhunter plot against Mortmain, and to meet you tonight."
Jessamine shook her head, plucking at the rough blanket.
"I will not betray him."
"Jesse."
Jem's voice was soft. Tessa did not know how Jessamine could hold out against him.
"Please, we are only asking you to save yourself. Send this message. Tell us your usual meeting place. That is all we ask."
Jessamine shook her head.
"Mortmain,"
she said.
"Mortmain will yet win out over you. Then the Silent Brothers will be defeated and Nate will come to claim me."
"Very well," said Tessa. "Imagine that does happen. You say Nate loves you. Then he would forgive you anything, wouldn't he? Because when a man loves a woman, he understands that she is weak, that she cannot hold out against, for instance, torture in the manner in which he could." Jessamine made a whimpering sound. "He understands that she is frail, and delicate, and easily led," Tessa went on, and gently touched Jessamine's arm. "Jesse, you see your choice. If you do not help us, the Clave will know it, and they will not be lenient with you. If you do help us, Nate will understand. If he loves you, he has no choice, for love means forgiveness."
"I..."
Jessamine looked from one of them to the other, like a frightened rabbit.
"Would you forgive Tessa, if it were her?"
"I would forgive Tessa anything," Jem said gravely. Tessa could not see his expression. She was facing Jessamine, but she felt her heart skip a beat. She could not look at Jem, too afraid her expression would betray her feelings.
"Jesse, please," she said instead.
Jessamine was silent for a long time. When she spoke, finally, her voice was as thin as a thread.
"You will be meeting him, I suppose, disguised as me,"
Tessa nodded.
"You must wear boy's clothes,"
she said.
"When I meet him at night, I am always dressed as a boy. It is safer for me to traverse the streets alone like that. He will expect it."
She looked up, pushing her matted hair out of her face.
"Have you a pen and paper?"
she added.
"I will write the note."
She took the proffered items from Jem and began to scribble.
"I ought to get something in return for this,"
she said.
"If they will not let me out..."
"They will not," said Jem, "until it is determined that your information is good."
"Then they ought to at least give me better food. It's dreadful here. Just gruel and hard bread."
Having finished scribbling the note, she handed it to Tessa.
"The boy's clothes I wear are behind the doll's house in my room. Take care moving it,"
she added, and for a moment again she was Jessamine, her brown eyes haughty,
And if you must borrow some of my clothes, do. You've been wearing the same 4 dresses I bought you in June over and over. That yellow one is practically ancient. And if you don't want anyone to know you've been kissing in carriages, you should refrain from wearing a hat with easily crushed flowers on it. People aren't blind, you know.
So it seems, said Jem, with great gravity. And when Tessa looked over at him, he smiled, just at her. Chapter 15. Thousands More. There is something horrible about a flower. This, broken in my hand, is one of those. You threw it in just now. It will not live another hour. There are thousands more. You do not miss a rose. Charlotte Mew, in Nunhead Cemetery. The rest of the day at the Institute passed in a mood of great tension, as the Shadow Hunters prepared for their confrontation with Nate that night. There were no formal meals again, only a great deal of rushing about, as weapons were readied and polished, gear was prepared, and maps consulted while Bridget, warbling mournful ballads, carried trays of sandwiches and tea up and down the halls. If it hadn't been for Sophie's invitation to come and have a pickle, Tessa probably wouldn't have eaten anything all day. As it was, her knotted throat would allow only a few bites of sandwich to slide down before she felt as if she were choking. "I'm going to see Nate tonight," she thought, staring at herself in the pier glass as Sophie knelt at her feet, lacing up her boots. Boys' boots from Jessamine's hidden trove of male clothing. "And then I'm going to betray him." She thought of the way Nate had lain in her lap in the carriage on the way from De Quincey's, and the way he had shrieked her name and held on to her when Brother Enoch had appeared. She wondered how much of that had been show. Probably at least part of him had been truly terrified, abandoned by Mortmain, hated by De Quincey. In the hands of Shadow Hunters, he had no reason to trust. Except that she had told him they were trustworthy, and he had not cared. He had wanted what Mortmain was offering him, more than he had wanted her safety, more than he had cared about anything else. All the years between them, the time that had knitted them together so closely that she had thought them inseparable, had meant nothing to him.
"You can't brood on it, miss,"
said Sophie, rising to her feet and dusting off her hands.
"He aren't... I mean, he isn't worth it."
"Who isn't worth it?"
"Your brother? Wasn't that what you were thinking on?"
Tessa squinted suspiciously. "Can you tell what I'm thinking because you have the sight?" Sophie laughed.
"Lord, no, miss. I can read it on your face like a book. You always have the same look when you think of Master Nathaniel. But he's a bad act, miss. Not worth your thoughts."
"He's my brother."
"That doesn't mean you like him,"
said Sophie decisively.
"Some are just born bad, and that's all there is to it."
Some imp of the perverse made Tessa ask. "And what of Will? Do you still think he was born bad? Lovely and poisonous like a snake, you said." Sophie raised her delicately arched eyebrows.
"Master Will is a mystery, no doubt."
Before Tessa could reply, the door swung open, and Jem stood in the doorway.
"Charlotte sent me to give you..." he began, and broke off, staring at Tessa.
She looked down at herself. Trousers, shoes, shirt, waistcoat, all in order. It was certainly a peculiar feeling wearing men's clothes. They were tight in places she was not used to clothes being tight, and loose in others. And they itched. But that hardly explained the look on Jem's face. Jem had flushed all over, red spreading up from his collar to his face.
"Charlotte sent me to tell you we've been waiting in the drawing room," he said.
Then he turned around and left the room hurriedly.
"Goodness," Tessa said, perplexed. "What was that about?"
Sophie chuckled softly.
"Well, look at yourself."
Tessa looked. She was flushed, she thought, her hair tumbling loose over her shirt and waistcoat. The shirt had clearly been made with something of a feminine figure in mind, since it did not strain over the bosom as much as Tessa had feared it would. Still, it was tight, thanks to Jessie's smaller frame. The trousers were tight as well, as was the fashion, molding themselves to her legs. She cocked her head to the side. There was something indecent about it, wasn't there? A man was not supposed to be able to see the shape of a lady's upper legs, or so much of the curve of her hips. There was something about the men's clothing that made her look not masculine, but undressed.
"My goodness," she said.
"Indeed," said Sophie. "Don't worry. He'll fit better once you change. And besides, he fancies you anyway."
You think he fancies me?"
"Quite," said Sophie, sounding unperturbed. "You should see the way he looks at you when he doesn't think you see. Or looks up when a door opens and is always disappointed when it isn't you. Master Jem, he didn't like Master Will. He can't hide what he's thinking."
"And you're not..." Tessa searched for words. "Sophie, you're not put out with me?"
"Why would I be put out with you?"
A little of the amusement had gone out of Sophie's voice, and now she sounded carefully neutral. "You're in for it now, Tessa," she thought.
"Well, I thought perhaps that there was a time when you looked at Jem with a certain admiration. That is all. I meant nothing improper, Sophie."
Sophie was silent for such a long time that Tessa was sure she was angry, or worse, terribly hurt. Instead, she said finally,
"There was a time when I admired him. He was so gentle and so kind, not like any man I'd known. And so lovely to look at. And the music he makes..."
She shook her head and her dark ringlets bounced.
"But he never cared for me. Never by a word or a gesture did he lead me to believe he returned my admiration, though he was never unkind."
"Sophie," Tessa said softly, "you have been more than a maidservant since I have come here. You have been a good friend. I would not do anything that might hurt you."
Sophie looked up at her.
"Do you care for him?"
"I think,"
Tessa said with slow caution,
"that I do."
"Good,"
Sophie exhaled.
"He deserves that. To be happy. Master Will has always been the brighter burning star, the one to catch attention. But Jem is a steady flame, unwavering and honest. He could make you happy."
"And you would not object?"
"Object?"
Sophie shook her head.
"Oh, Miss Tessa, it is kind of you to care what I think, but no, I would not object. My fondness for him, and that is all it was, a girlish fondness, has quite cooled into friendship. I wish only his happiness and yours."
Tessa was amazed. All the worrying she had done about Sophie's feelings, and Sophie didn't mind at all. What had changed since Sophie had wept over Jem's illness the night of the Blackfriars Bridge debacle? Unless...
"Have you been walking out with someone? Cyril, or..." Sophie rolled her eyes.
"Oh, Lord have mercy on us all. First Thomas, now Cyril. When will you stop trying to marry me off to the nearest available man?"
"There must be someone."
"There is no one,"
Sophie said firmly, rising to her feet, and turning Tessa toward the pier glass.
"There you are. Twist up your hair under your hat, and you'll be the model of a gentleman."
Tessa did as she was told. When Tessa came into the library, the small band of Institute shadow hunters, Jem, Will, Henry, and Charlotte, all in gear now, were grouped around a table on which a small oblong device made of brass was balanced. Henry was gesturing at it animatedly, his voice rising.
"This," he was saying, "is what I have been working on for just this occasion. It is specifically calibrated to function as a weapon against clockwork assassins."
"As dull as Nate Gray is," Will said.
"His head is not actually filled with gears, Henry. He's a human."
He may bring one of those creatures with him. We don't know. He'll be there unaccompanied. If nothing else, that clockwork coachman of Mortmain's...
I think Henry is right, said Tessa, and they all whirled to face her. Jem flushed again, though more lightly this time, and offered her a crooked smile. Will's eyes ran up and down her body once, not briskly. He said,
You don't look like a boy at all. You look like a girl in boy's clothes.
She couldn't tell if he was approving, disapproving, or neutral on the subject. I am not trying to fool anyone but a casual observer, she replied crossly. Nate knows Jessamine's a girl, and the clothes will fit me better once I've changed into her.
Maybe you should do it now, said Will.
Tessa glared at him, then shut her eyes. It was different, changing into someone you had been before. She did not need to be holding something of theirs, or to be near them. It was like closing her eyes and reaching into a wardrobe, detecting a familiar garment by touch and drawing it out. She reached for Jessamine inside herself and let her free, wrapping the Jessamine disguise around herself, feeling the breath pushed from her lungs as her ribcage contracted, her hair slipping from its twist to fall in light corn silk waves against her face. She pushed it back up under the hat and opened her eyes. They were all staring at her. Jem was the only one to offer a smile as she blinked in the light.
Uncanny, said Henry.
His hand rested lightly on the object on the table. Tessa, uncomfortable with the eyes on her, moved toward it. What is that?
It's a sort of infernal device that Henry's created, Jem said. Meant to disrupt the internal mechanisms that keep the clockwork creatures running. You twist it like this.
Henry mimed twisting the bottom half of the thing in one direction and the top half in another.
And then throw it. Try to lodge it into the creature's gears or somewhere that it will stick. It is meant to disrupt the mechanical currents that run through the creature's body, causing them to wrench apart. It could do you some damage, too, even if you aren't clockwork, so don't hang on to it once it's activated. I've only two, so...
He handed one to Jem and another to Charlotte, who took it and hung it from her weapons belt without a word. The message has been sent? Tessa asked.
Yes. We're only waiting for a reply from your brother now, said Charlotte.
She unrolled a paper across the surface of the table, weighting down the corners with copper gears from a stack Henry must have left there.
Here, she said, is a map that shows where Jessamine claims she and Nate usually meet. It's a warehouse on Mincing Lane, down by Lower Thames Street. It used to be a tea merchant's packing factory until the business went bankrupt.
Mincing Lane, said Jem.
Center of the tea trade. Also the opium trade.
Makes sense Mortmain might keep a warehouse there. He ran a slender finger over the map, tracing the names of the nearby streets. Eastcheap, Gracechurch Street, Lower Thames Street, St. Swithin's Lane.
Such an odd place for Jessamine, though, he said.
She always dreamed of such glamour, of being introduced at court and putting her hair up for dances.
Not of clandestine meetings in some sooty warehouse near the wharves.
She did do what she set out to do, Tessa said. She married someone who isn't a shadow hunter. Will's mouth quirked into a half-smile.
If the marriage were valid, she'd be your sister-in-law.
Tessa shuddered. It's not that I hold a grudge against Jessamine, but she deserves better than my brother.
Anyone deserves better than that.
Will reached under the table and drew out a rolled-up bunch of fabric. He spread it across the table, avoiding the map. Inside were several long, thin weapons, each with a gleaming rune carved into the blade.
I'd nearly forgotten I had Thomas order these for me a few weeks ago.
They've only just arrived.
Misericords. Good for getting in between the jointure of those clockwork creatures.
The question is, Jem said, lifting one of the misericords and examining the blade. Once we get Tessa inside to meet Nate, how do the rest of us watch their meeting without being noticed? We must be ready to intervene at any moment, especially if it appears that his suspicions have been aroused.
We must arrive first and hide ourselves, said Will. It is the only way. We listen to see if Nate says anything useful.
I dislike the idea of Tessa being forced to speak with him at all, muttered Jem.
She can well hold her own. I have seen it. Besides, he is more likely to speak freely if he thinks himself safe. Once captured, even if the Silent Brothers do explore his mind, Mortmain may have thought to put blocks in it to protect his knowledge, which can take time to dismantle. I think Mortmain has put in blocks in Jessamine's case, said Tessa. For whatever it is worth, I cannot touch her thoughts. Even more likely he will have done it in Nate's then, said Will.
That boy is as weak as a kitten, said Henry. He will tell us whatever we want to know, and if not, I have a device. Henry!
Charlotte looked seriously alarmed.
Tell me you have not been working on a torture device. Not at all. I call it the Confuser. It emits a vibration that directly affects the human brain, rendering it incapable of telling between fiction and fact.
Henry, looking proud, reached for his box.
He will simply spill everything that is in his mind, with no attention to the consequences.
Charlotte held up a warning hand.
Not right now, Henry. If we must utilize the Confuser on Nate Gray, we will do so when we have brought him back here. At the moment, we must concentrate on reaching the warehouse before Tessa. It is not that far. I suggest Cyril take us there, then returns for Tessa.
Nate will recognize the Institute's carriage, Tessa objected. When I saw Jessamine leaving for a meeting with Nate, she was most decidedly going on foot.
I shall walk.
You will get lost, said Will.
I won't, said Tessa, indicating the map. It's a simple walk. I could turn left at Gracechurch Street, go along Eastcheap, and cut through to Mincing Lane.
An argument ensued, with Jem, to Tessa's surprise, siding with Will against the idea of her walking the streets alone. Eventually it was decided that Henry would drive the carriage to Mincing Lane while Tessa would walk, with Cyril following her at a discreet distance, lest she lose herself in the crowded, dirty, noisy city. With a shrug, she agreed. It seemed less trouble than arguing, and she didn't mind Cyril.
"I don't suppose anyone's going to point out," said Will, "that once again we are leaving the Institute without a shadow hunter to protect it."
Charlotte rolled up the map with a flick of her wrist.
"And which of us would you suggest stay home, then, instead of helping Tessa?"
"I didn't say anything about anyone staying home," Will's voice dropped. "But Cyril will be with Tessa. Sophie's only half-trained, and Bridget..."
Tessa glanced over at Sophie, who was sitting quietly in the corner of the library. But the other girl gave no sign of having heard Will. Meanwhile, Bridget's voice was wafting faintly from the kitchen, another miserable ballad.
So John took out of his pocket a knife both long and sharp, and stuck it through his brother's heart, and the blood came pouring down. Says John to William, take off thy shirt, and tear it from gore to gore, and wrap it round your bleeding heart, and the blood will pour no more.
By the angel, said Charlotte, we really are going to have to do something about her before she drives us all to madness, aren't we?
Before anyone could reply, two things happened at once. Something tapped at the window, startling Tessa so much that she took a step back, and a great echoing noise sounded through the Institute, the sound of the summoning bell. Charlotte said something to Will, lost in the noise of the bell, and he left the room, while Charlotte crossed it, slid the window up and open, and captured something hovering outside. She turned away from the window, a fluttering piece of paper in her hand. It looked a bit like a white bird, edges flapping in the breeze. Her hair blew about her face, too, and Tessa was reminded how young Charlotte was.
"From Nate, I suppose," said Charlotte. "His message for Jessamine."
She brought it to Tessa, who tore the creamy parchment lengthwise in her eagerness to get it open. Tessa glanced up. "It is from Nate," she confirmed. "He has agreed to meet Jessie in the usual place at sundown." She gave a little gasp as, recognizing itself somehow as having been read, the note burst into quick, heatless flames, consuming itself,
until it was only a film of black ash on her fingers.
"That gives us only a little time," said Henry. "I will go and tell Cyril to ready the carriage."
He looked to Charlotte as if for approval, but she only nodded without meeting his eyes. With a sigh, Henry left the room, nearly bumping into Will, who was on his way back in, followed by a figure in a traveling cloak. For a moment, Tessa wondered in confusion if it was the Silent Brother, until the visitor drew his hood back, and she saw the familiar sandy blonde curling hair and green eyes.
"Gideon Lightwood," she said in surprise.
"There." Charlotte slipped the map she was holding into her pocket.
"The Institute will not be shadow hunterless."
Sophie got hastily to her feet, then froze, as if, outside the atmosphere of the training room, she was not sure what to do or say in front of the eldest Lightwood brother. Gideon glanced around the room. As always, his green eyes were calm, unruffled. Will, behind him, seemed to burn with bright energy by contrast, even when he was simply standing still.
"You called on me?" Gideon said,
and she realized that, of course, looking at her, he was seeing Jessamine.
"And I am here, though I know not why or what for."
"To train Sophie, ostensibly," said Charlotte, "and also to look after the Institute while we're gone. We need a shadow hunter of age to be present, and you qualify. In fact, it was Sophie who suggested you."
"And how long will you be gone?"
2 hours, 3, not all night."
"All right."
Gideon began to unbutton his cloak. There was dust on his boots, and his hair looked as if he had been out in the cold wind, hatless.
"My father would say it was good practice for when I run the place."
Will muttered something under his breath that sounded like bloody cheek. He looked at Charlotte, who shook her head at him minutely.
"It may be that the Institute will be yours one day," she said to Gideon quite mildly.
"In any case, we're grateful for your assistance. The Institute is the responsibility of all shadow hunters, after all. These are our dwelling places, our Idris away from home."
Gideon turned to Sophie.
"Are you ready to train?"
She nodded. They left the room together in a group, Gideon and Sophie turning right to make their way to the training room, the rest of them heading for the stairs.